Welcome everybody to our Friday evening study. Today is November the 6th, 2009. This is the second study in a two-study series. It's entitled, Binding the Testimony, Part 2. The scriptures tell us in Isaiah chapter 8, I'm not going to take you to that text at this time. It says, bind up the testimony, seal the law among my disciples. The Lord looked forward to the opportunity and the time, as we saw, because Isaiah continues to say, and I will wait upon the Lord. He looked with anticipation to the return of the Lord. His commission was to bind up the testimony and to seal the law. We know that the testimony is a reference to nothing other than the gospel that was declared by Jesus for his 3.5 years, during which time Christ, the God of the Old Testament, the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, the one who presided over Israel and led them in their theological as well as their spiritual as well as their literal and political journey, rested and abode clandestinely upon Jesus. This abiding was prophesied from the text that we're all very familiar with, Deuteronomy 18. And as he declared these words, we're told in John chapter 16, the text just before the Lord ended his work, that he had spoken to us in Proverbs. The Lord assured us that the day was going to come when he would speak to us plainly. This text is reaffirmed in other scripture that we have taken under consideration, whereby the Lord promised to raise up his word again in the last day. The mustard seed advent is the voice, the inspired voice that the Lord has elected to remind us of the testimony of Jesus. So when we talk about binding up the testimony, we're given the commission to take the admonition and the advice that the Lord issued during his 3.5 years of ministry. Advice that was handed to him and dictated to him directly from the Father. And we are to harmonize that with the law. Hence, bind up the testimony, seal the law. It's evident that we as Adventists have never fully appreciated the law, merely by the fact that until recently we've just learned the first two commandments of the Ten Commandments. Imagine that, there's only Ten Commandments. In all these years, since their declaration 3,500 years ago, we did not discern the first commandment or the second commandment. This had to be a matter of study. The first commandment forbade us to make graven images. The second commandment forbade us from bowing down and worshiping them. We've been so focused on the fourth commandment that we've been ignorant of the others. But I contend, how can you bind the testimony and seal the law unless you know what the law is, unless you're familiar with all of the commandments? One of the points that I had attempted to communicate to you through these series of studies was how the law relates to our behavior. Heretofore, we thought that the law was a document that was handed to us, and that there were no gray areas whereby you could have discretion as to how the law applied. But under that system of belief and under those circumstances, the law becomes an impossible document because it does not meet the circumstances that become applicable to us from day to day. To illustrate, and I think we should really have several illustrations of this. This is an important point. The law says honor your mother and father. Yet, if your mother and father take opposition to your efforts to advance the cause of the Lord, then how do you respond? You can't be locked into the law unless you have the testimony, which is a judgment of how to proceed in the law. The law tells you that thou shalt not kill. But if you read Leviticus, Numbers, and Deuteronomy, there were several mandates whereby the children of Israel were commanded to kill. In those situations, more often than not, the Lord gave an accountability for the law by saying, let their blood be upon their own heads. If you were to go out and to murder somebody, you couldn't hide behind the law, thou shalt not kill, to preserve your life. the governance of Israel had a responsibility to punish you accordingly, and your blood was on your own hands. There have been people that have taken that to the extreme. You've all heard illustrations of this. They say that thou shalt not kill applies to killing animals for food consumption. Some people think it applies to killing harmful insects or nuisances. You see, there's a vast opportunity to exploit the law unless you have wisdom. And this is why the testimony has to be bound up and married to the law. Otherwise, it's difficult, if not impossible, for people to comply with the law. Not because the law is unbearable, but simply because the law can be made a document of confusion. On the street, the avenue, before you get to my house, there's a speed limit of 25 miles an hour. Does that mean that on every avenue, on every highway, you're limited to 25 miles an hour? No. People have taken the law which prohibits speeding and have applied it to the specific circumstances that prevail. If you're going through a school zone, you have to slow down even slower than that. If you're on a major highway, you can go as fast as 65 miles an hour. And then there's flexibility to that. According to the state of Pennsylvania, and I believe a lot of other states, you are not really defined as a speed violator unless you go more than 6 miles an hour above the limit. The same is applicable to the law of God. The reason why the commission is to bind up the testimony and seal the law is because the disciples are the ones that will have to adjudicate the provisions of the law. This is a concept that we are very, very unfamiliar with. But we will be made judges. So therefore, the circumstances that prevail will have to discern whether the party was in violation or whether they were not. That should not be shocking, because we know that the Lord, for a span of time, before the kings emerged, he appointed judges to preside over Israel. Samuel was a case in point. If there was a dispute, it was not clear how the dispute measured up to the law, and the judge had to make a judgment. And the Lord affirmed a lot of these judgments during his testimony because he showed them that they would make an exception to the Sabbath law by extricating a helpless animal that had fallen in a pit. It's a lot of work extricating an animal from a pit, especially a heavy animal. Somebody along the way took the Sabbath law and made a judgment which heaven honored. Quite naturally, you're wondering, suppose the judge makes an improper decision. Suppose the judge tells you that your proceedings with respect to a particular law violates where the Lord thinks that it doesn't violate. Isn't that exactly what the Lord was faced with when in Mark chapter 3 he marched into the temple and desired to heal the man with the withered hand? The people faltered in their judgment. Consequently, the lesson there is when there is a faltering in the judgment and the judge makes a misjudgment, you can always rely upon the Lord to make corrections. That's the flexibility of the law. Let me just give you an illustration that applies to our experience as Adventists. There are those who have written that E.G. White borrowed a lot of her literature, and she did so without giving proper credit. And the law says that that's plagiarism. That's wrong. And plagiarism is nothing but a fancy word that's saying stealing. The Bible, of course, says, thou shalt not steal. But the unique thing about it is that the laws of plagiarism, as far as I understand, and I say this, I'm not a legal expert, are only really recent manifestations of legal judgments. We refer to that as a testimony. Evidence of the fact is that Thomas Jefferson, those of you that are familiar with the Declaration of Independence, Thomas Jefferson borrowed 95% of that covenant from a philosopher, theologian, by the name of John Locke. And nobody assails his work as being plagiarized. Because the concept of taking somebody's work without giving them credit is something that has advanced in time. But according to today's law, the Lord himself would have had to have been fined or excoriated because he is on record of quoting themes that Confucius uttered 500 years before. You've heard the golden rule, right? Do unto others as you would have them do unto you. Was the Lord wrong? Was he in violation of the law? The answer to that leads us to our understanding. It depends upon the judge. We are commissioned to make righteous judgments. If Confucius instructed his throngs on the gold rule 500 years before the Lord, then the Lord, when he came back, could have only been repeating himself. The same with E.G. White. If somebody else, centuries before her work, wrote volumes and volumes of literature that was beneficial to the Adventist movement, then the Lord has authority to repeat himself. Hence, we have a situation whereby the Adventist movement is assailed by unrighteous judgments. This is why we need the disciples. This is why we have to bind up the testimony and seal the law among the disciples, so that they can make judgments that are righteous and beneficial. And you do so by carefully examining the testimony of Jesus. In Matthew chapter 6, verse 22 and verse 23, it says, "The light of the body is the eye. If therefore thine eye be single, the whole body shall be full of light. But if thine eye be evil, the whole body shall be full of darkness. If therefore the light that is in thee be darkness, how great is that darkness?" The Lord is telling us that the world will not be able to continue unless they're benefited by the light of heaven, unless they have the singleness of purpose. We refer to this as the single eye. Those of us who have the benefit of vision, we know that we have what is referred to as binocular vision. You have two eyes, but when those eyes operate correctly as designed by creation, your mind translates that image into a single image so that your body can perceive and not be confused. This is the thesis of oneness that the Lord requires for his disciples. And this is the day of unity that is mentioned in the Scripture. You remember what Paul tells you in Ephesians chapter 4, verses 11 through 13? He gave some apostles, some prophets, some evangelists, some pastors and teachers for the work of the ministry. For the what? For the edifying of the body of Christ, till we all come in the unity of the faith and of the knowledge of the Son of God unto a perfect man, unto the measure of the stature of the fullness of Christ. Our benefits from inspiration were to lead us to this day when we would be able to walk in unison. And that speaks directly to the text at hand, Matthew chapter 6, whereby the church will have singular vision. Multiple eyes, but a singular vision. Imagine how confusing it would be if the church had multiple vision, multiple purpose. The whole body of Christ would continue to grope in darkness. Hence, when you think of the single eye, you need to understand how the light is to enter into the body. Let us take a few moments to direct our attention to the book of the Second Chronicle. Let's go to chapter 21. Verse 5, it says, "Jehoram was 32 years old when he began to reign, and he reigned 8 years in Jerusalem." Jehoram was one of the presiding sons of David. He descended through multi-generations, and in this text he presided, but he was a wicked king. Verse 6, "And he walked in the way of the kings of Israel, like as did the house of Ahab, for he had the daughter of Ahab to wife. And he wrought that which was evil in the eyes of the Lord." Very interesting insertion point there, in the eyes of the Lord. According to Jehoram, it was probably activity that was acceptable, but in the Lord's judgment, he wrought evil. Verse 7 is the text that we want. "Howbeit the Lord would not destroy the house of David because of the covenant that he made with David." Think about that for a second. The Lord made an agreement with David. When you perceive the details of such an agreement, you have to abstract yourself from the common understanding of covenants and agreements. I know we make agreements with people all the time. And as soon as times get rough, as soon as things get hard, these agreements are breached. But the Lord is not such a person. He abides by his covenant. This is why the Lord would not destroy the house of David. He destroyed the house of Saul. Saul violated his counsel. But the Lord did not make a covenant with Saul that his household would preside forever. So when Saul abrogated the agreement that the Lord had with him on how to preside as king over Israel, and the leadership and authority in Israel was taken from the house of Saul and given to David. And now we have the house of David in a similar circumstance. The question we would naturally be inclined to ask is, well, why wasn't the similar treatment given to the house of David? Why wasn't leadership taken from the house of David and transferred to somebody else? The Lord could have spent an eternity transferring his covenant of leadership to different households. That's not the way he discerned to proceed. And an important lesson that we need to garner is that no matter how evil the house of David became, the covenant with the house of David stood fast. Don't let anybody tell you that the Lord abrogated the covenant because Israel sinned. We have direct evidence to the contrary. The Lord doesn't abrogate his covenants that promise eternal benefit without condition. It says, howbeit the Lord would not destroy the house of David because of the covenant that he made with David. And as he promised to give a light to him and to his sons forever. When does forever end? Now, this text we're told took place in B.C. 896. Did forever end 100 years after that? What about 200 years? Can we expect the theme of foreverness to last beyond the ministry of Jesus? The theme of foreverness, is it enforceable today? Yes, indeed it is. Forever, based upon the word of the Lord, means forever. The Lord promised that the house of David would have his light, that it would emerge through his sons forever. That term sons is pluralized. There are some that hastily want to move away from that concept that's applied to Jesus. But we see that it was not the case. After Jeroboam, there were other sons that descended from the lineage of David who continued onward in righteousness. Zerubbabel was such a son. And the Lord promised that his house would be the house that would reign eternally, fulfilling the promise as it extended through David. For Zerubbabel was of the lineage of David. Therefore, when you read in Luke chapter 12, verse 42, what does it say there? Lord speaking. This is the Father's affirmation of the covenant that was made to the house of David. Verse 42, Luke 12, 42. And the Lord said, who then is that faithful and wise steward whom his Lord shall make ruler over his household to give them their portion of meat in due season? I find that question most appropriate. Who then is that steward? We know that he has to descend from the house of David through Zerubbabel. That's who he is. How do we know that? Because the Lord's going to make him ruler over his household. We haven't seen how rulership yet was going to be distended through the sons of David as well. We merely saw evidence that he would be a light forever. But notice what it says in the text. To give them their portion of meat in due season. And that's a synonym for a broadcaster of truth, of light. It says, blessed is that servant whom his Lord, when he cometh, shall find so doing. This servant is going to emerge just before the Lord's return. Right? And the blessing is given because at the Lord's invisible return, he finds this steward feeding the flock meat in due season. Now would be a good time to turn to Isaiah chapter 8 so that we can quote that correctly. But I don't want you to lose the text that we're in right now. It says in verse 16, bind up the testimony, seal the law among my disciples. The plurality there. The law is to be sealed by this commander. He's given the mandate to bind up the testimony and seal the law among the Lord's disciples. Then he says, and I will wait upon the Lord. Why is he waiting on the Lord? He's waiting for the Lord to return. I will wait upon the Lord that hideth his face from the house of Jacob, and I will look for him. Therefore, we know who it is now. We've answered that ponderable expressed to us by the Lord in Luke chapter 12. Who then is that faithful and wise steward? Blessed is that servant whom his Lord, when he cometh, shall so find doing. Now, I like this next expression. It says, of a truth, I say unto you, that he will make him ruler over all that he hath. This faithful and wise steward, the one who takes the Lord's testimony, has to be the testimony that he takes, because that was Christ's passion. He tells us many times throughout his 3.5-year testimony that he came to declare to us the Father's will, His word, and His commands. These are the testimonies that Emmanuel in Isaiah chapter 8 is sealing and binding among the disciples. And the Lord is so pleased with that, that just before He comes, this servant is raised up to do that very commission. Then He makes them, shockingly and surprisingly, ruler over all that He has. Now let's do a thought process here. Take a second to pause and try to envision what are some of the things that we know that the Lord has. It's rhetorical right now. We're going to address that as we advance. The faithful and wise steward is a ruler. He's a light. And He's a commander. Isaiah chapter 55. The Lord says, "Wherefore do you spend money, verse 2, for that which is not bread, and your labor for that which satisfieth not? Hearken diligently unto me, and eat ye that which is good, and let your soul delight in fatness." Where are they going to get this food, this proverbial food that the Lord says is good, this bread? He says, "Eat ye that which is good." He gets it from the one who distributes meat in due season. We said already that that has to be the light bearer, the light of Israel, which is a descendant, a last day descendant from the lineage of David. "Incline your ear and come unto me. Hear, and your soul shall live." Now how in the world are you going to come to the Lord? Back at Sinai, they tried that experiment already, didn't they? And when the Lord began to broadcast His truth, instead of coming to Him, they fled. They come because the Lord hides His presence on His servant. Matthew chapter 27, is it? Verses 31 through 35, I believe it is, speaks to this. It says, "O Jerusalem, Jerusalem, thou that killest the prophets and stonest them that are sent unto thee, how often would I have gathered thy children as a hen gathereth their chickens under her wings, and ye would not. Behold, your house is left unto you desolate. For I say unto you, ye shall not see me henceforth, till ye shall say, Blessed is he that cometh in the name of the Lord." So they see the Lord through His servant. The servant is the light of Israel, because Israel covenanted with Christ that He would no longer shine His brightness upon them. It was too menacing. Thus, in Isaiah chapter 55, verse 3 has special meaning now. This person who delivers meat in due season, this disciple gatherer, says, "Incline your ear, come unto me, and here your soul shall live." Well, how can you come to the Lord if you're not alive? This is a testament about eternal life. This is the requisite for eternal life. It could only be applicable today. "I will make an everlasting covenant with you, even the sure mercies of David. Behold, I have given them for a witness to the people, a leader and a commander to the people." David is a leader, a commander, and he's a lawgiver, a judge. And this is why he binds up the testimony and he seals the law. We knew all along that that day would come, because the Lord told us in John chapter 14. It says, let's read verse 24, "He that loveth me not keepeth not my sayings." That is a recommendation to keep the testimony that the Lord delivered. For that determines if you love the Lord. "He that loveth me not keepeth not my sayings. And the word which ye hear is not mine, but the Father's which sent me. These things have I spoken unto you, being yet present with you." Hence, the testimony of Jesus that recommends you to the Father and manifests that you love the Lord is those things that He spoke to the disciples while He was yet present with you. "But the Comforter, which is the Holy Ghost, whom the Father will send in my name, He shall teach you all things, and bring all things to your remembrance, whatsoever I have said unto you." Ah, so now we understand how David gets his light. Before the Lord comes, the Comforter shines through him and reminds him of the testimony which the Lord issued. So it's important, isn't it, to garner up the testimony. Last week we determined that there are those that are going to unite with David's work, and they're going to be disciples, didn't we? And then some of them may not receive the exalted status of discipleship, but they may receive some other classification, some other rank. We see that there are 12 thrones for the disciples, because Matthew chapter 19 tells us that the reward for those who stay with the Lord in the day of regeneration That's the day when Israel is regathered. Degenerate Israel is regenerated. In that day, he said, ye shall sit on the 12 thrones of Israel, judging the 12 tribes. That's one of the best blessings and the benefits of being a disciple. The Lord gave us a special criterion. He said, Matthew chapter 5, verse 20, unless your righteousness exceed the righteousness of whom? The scribes and the Pharisees, ye shall in no wise enter into the kingdom of heaven. That shows you that the people during the judgment of the living, the people who are invited to come, have to gain entry into the eternal kingdom to win their life by doing what? Having their righteousness exceed the righteousness of the scribes and the Pharisees. One lesson we learn very well in this series from Mark chapter 3, one very key point that the Pharisees observed was the Sabbath. They were careful Sabbatarians, weren't they? Therefore, everybody in the judgment of living that enters into the kingdom has to be a better Sabbatarian than the scribes and Pharisees. Scribes and Pharisees, other criterion. Normally I would go to Matthew chapter 23, verse 23. Woe is pronounced of them because even though they were careful tithe payers, they failed in other areas. So the Lord shows us their successes and their failures. Now we know from that, by having this testimony bound up amongst us, the qualifications for entry into the kingdom. But entry into the kingdom does not make you a disciple. Jerusalem is going to be converted to enter into the kingdom. But they're going to be judged by the 12 disciples. The Lord gives you the criterion for discipleship. And we were careful to list some of those criteria. One of them, I believe, is found in Matthew chapter 10. It says that you have to hate your mother, your father, your sister, your brother, even your wife, even your own self. Unless you do that, you cannot enter into the kingdom. Is that what it says? No. It says you cannot be my disciple. To be a good judge, you have to manifest before the universe that anybody who violates the Lord's counsel does not win your approbation and your favor. So if you have this great love for your family members, then the secret is to convert them now to become a disciple. Disciples have to manifest love amongst each other. There's a dark day in Adventist history with the Black American experience because a lot of times we could not even look to our own Adventist brethren for help. I remember they did not even extend the same graces to us to go to their schools as they extended to other groups. That's a manifestation of a failure to love. The disciples cannot do that. They cannot show partiality because somebody's connected them in a closer, more enduring way. Well, this is my kinfolk, or this is my neighbor, or this is a person of my own race, or this is a person of my own ethnicity. No, your commission is to love one another. Your graces are to be extended to the disciples. Oftentimes when I give these studies, I'll ask my wife some questions, and more often than not, I get the answers I'm looking for, but sometimes the answers are missed. And one of the ponderables that I found that we need to focus more on is how you become categorized as a disciple or just somebody that is an assistant to the disciple. What are the benefits for reaching out to become a disciple? I know you get, as we stated, to sit and judge the 144,000. That's one of the benefits. But the greatest benefit to being a disciple is expressed in John chapter 16. You may recall from John chapter 14 to John chapter 16, the Lord expresses to the disciples they had to leave. They became sad. So he began to comfort them. And that's why he gave promise to send the comforter. He told them that you're going to have sorrow. All the way up until one point in time. That's when the man-child is born. Then your sorrows are going to eternally go away. And you're going to have everlasting joy that nobody can take away from you. So the pain and the suffering and the anguish that you feel, the promise is the day is going to come when you're going to have eternal joy. I know some of you are happy already, some of you are celebrating already, but it's going to get even better. The Lord promises you everlasting joy. That's one of the great benefits. That seems to suggest to me that there are some people that will have lingering problems, and we'll speak hopefully more to this as we advance, they're going to have lingering problems even as they unite with the kingdom. That seems like a hard saying, but that's one of the benefits of reaching out to be a disciple. You may be surprised to find out, as we had discussed this the last time, that there's categories even among the disciples. Let's read in Matthew chapter 12, verse 46. We're going to read verse 47 and 8 as well. While he yet talked to the people, to whom? The Lord was conducting a major study, perhaps a Sabbath service. There were throngs of people around. So much so, as we see, something strange happened, since his mother and his brother stood without, desiring to speak with him. His family could not penetrate the throngs to interrupt the Lord to speak with him. Then one said unto him, Behold, thy mother and thy brethren stand without, desiring to speak with thee. But he answered and said unto him that told him, Who is my mother, and who are my brethren? And he stretched forth his hand toward his disciples, and said, Behold, my mother and my brethren. Verse 50. For whosoever shall do the will of my Father, which is in heaven, the same is my brother and sister and mother. That's quite an enlightenment. Because now he takes the disciples and he categorizes them into three separate groups. Aren't you glad that the Lord is now binding up this testimony amongst us? He could have pointed to the throngs and said, These aren't my mother, my brother, and my sister. But he did not do that, right? He turned and pointed to his disciples. And he said, To become a disciple, you have to do the will of my Father, which is in heaven. And those who do that are my brother, my mother, and my sister. That means that some of us are going to serve as disciples in a male perspective. Some are going to serve as a disciple as a female. And some are going to receive a maternal assignment. These are going to be the people that are going to be the Lord's brother, sister, mother. Therefore, you automatically know what your duties and assignments are going to be. Now, when you have a family, you notice that duties and assignments are broken up amongst those categories. If you live out in the country and it's time to go, get up early and to chop wood, then you send usually the sons out to do that. When it's time to clean the house internally, you have the women do that and to prepare the meals. And everybody knows the assignment that the mother has. We have a breakdown of now the categories of disciples that are going to be in the kingdom. But the most important point is that women and men are given equal status in this categorization. They're just given different assignments. The Lord refers to them as his disciples as well. Expanding upon that point, let us go to a completely different direction. Let us turn to Zechariah, chapter 4, verses 6 and 7. Then he answered and spake unto me, saying, This is the word of the Lord unto Zerubbabel. If you go to the genealogy that's expressed in, I believe it's Luke chapter 3, you see that Zerubbabel was of the lineage of ancient David. The Lord was using Zerubbabel. Zerubbabel was a governor that was appointed to lead out in God's house after they had returned back to Jerusalem from their Babylonian dispersion. The Lord used that ancient governor as an icon, as a symbol of the one through whom the faithful and wise steward would emerge. It's a reinstatement of the light of Israel concept that was covenanted to David and his sons. It says, This is the word of the Lord unto Zerubbabel. Hence, we see that the testimony of Jesus is to be communicated to Zerubbabel through the apparatus that's described earlier. Not by might nor by power, but mine by spirit, saith the Lord of hosts. Zerubbabel's emergence is not going to be by his might or by his power. Well, that's another way of saying that he starts out in a very insignificant way. For if you don't have might or power, you're insignificant. Another synonymous way to describe that would be as the mustard seed, the least of all seeds. Who art thou, O great mountain, before Zerubbabel? Thou shalt become a plain. Well, that's good news, isn't it? That's reaffirming what we've learned from John chapter 16. This is the day of joy that he's speaking of. The day when the mountains of trouble are eliminated and become a plain. And he shall bring forth the headstone thereof with shouting, crying, grace, grace unto it. So the headstone comes forward, the leaders of God's people. And they are the purveyors of grace. They are the ones that give the ministry of grace. They are the ones that direct themselves to the 144,000. The ones to whom the 144,000 say, blessed is he that cometh in the name of the Lord. Moreover, the word of the Lord came unto me, saying, verse 8, the hands of Zerubbabel have laid the foundation of this house. His hands shall also finish it. And thou shalt know that the Lord of hosts hath sent me unto you. Verse 10, for who hath despised the day of small things? Little, insignificant, mightless, powerless Zerubbabel. Some people never anticipated that he would be the purveyor of power. So they ignored and despised the day of small things. For they shall rejoice and shall see the plummet in the hand of Zerubbabel with those seven. With those seven. That's what I wanted you to see. Zerubbabel has the plummet in his hands. And he's got some helpers. He's got seven helpers, right? Well, come on. Now, I thought there were going to be 12 disciples. 12 thrones, 12 disciples. No, the scriptures are telling us that Zerubbabel has the plummet in his hand with those seven. What do you suppose that means? The plummet is a symbol of a house-building tool. This is the work of the seven. I mean, you don't put a tool belt on, put hammers and nails in the hands of your daughters, do you? The people who erect the house are those who you would anticipate would be the masculine portion of the household of the Lord. Zerubbabel with the plummet has with those seven. It's difficult work building a house. It's not as easy as you may think. It takes a lot of sawing, a lot of hammering, a lot of measuring, a lot of nailing. It's not a delightful thing. It's not a work that females are usually ascribed to. Who are the seven? It says, for who hath despised the day of small things? For they shall rejoice and shall see the plummet in the hand of Zerubbabel with those seven. They are the eyes of the Lord. They're the what? The eyes of the Lord which run to and fro through the whole earth. Consequently, these seven with Zerubbabel rule the earth. They go throughout the earth and they see the themes that need to be corrected. They are the judges. They are those that make sure that people measure up to the building standard. That's one way of putting it, using the illustration of a house builder. 2 Samuel chapter 7, verse 8 through 12, keeping our thoughts with Zerubbabel, it says, now therefore, so shalt thou say unto my servant David. I'm just reading snippets of this. I will appoint a place for my people Israel, and I will plant them, that they may dwell in a place of their own, and move no more, neither shall the children of wickedness afflict them anymore. That's never happened. That's a promise for today, the children of Israel. And when thy days be fulfilled, speaking of David, and thou shalt sleep with thy father, I will set up thy seed after thee, it's a son, and he shall build an house for my name, and I will establish the throne of his kingdom forever. We're talking about the different classifications among the disciples. David, his seed, Zerubbabel, his seed, represent the house builders. We could use different metaphors in the scriptures because another metaphor also stipulates that men take the assignment and responsibility is the illustration of harvesters. That was never a duty that was assigned to the women. There's no reason to believe that these eyes of the Lord, those of the Lord's evangelism team, they are the ones that have the singular vision. It doesn't just take a psychoptic individual to have singular vision. We've seen that you can have binocular vision. Now the Lord has seven eyes, complete vision, and they go to and fro throughout the earth, looking for house building material. They are the eyes of the Lord. So we see in Samuel that the son of David is the house builder. It says, he shall build an house for my name, and I will establish the throne of his kingdom forever. We find that in 2 Samuel. We took snippets from chapter 7, verse 8 through 13. Let's read a little bit more about those seven. One of these days we're going to do a study about the women's participation. The Lord's got brothers and sisters. I'd like to refer you to Micah chapter 5, verse 2. Actually, this is a beautiful study. If you take it from the end of chapter 3 all the way through the middle of chapter 5, a lot of light and truth. We don't have time to examine it in its entirety. I know that many of you have already given a lot of study to this. But thou, Bethlehem Ephratah, though thou be little among the thousands of Judah, yet out of thee shall he come forth unto me. That is to be ruler in Israel. Who's going to come to him? The ruler. We saw that ruler defined by Luke chapter 12, defined by Isaiah chapter 55, is the son of David. Defined also by the text we were just in, Zerubbabel and Zechariah. So this ruler in Israel is going to return to the Lord. Yet out of thee shall he come forth unto me, that is to be ruler in Israel, whose going forth has been from old, from everlasting. Doesn't mean that he's been living everlasting, but his emergence, his growth, his development from a helpless person without any might or power to a magnificent ruler, that is part of the plan of redemption that the Father had forged from everlasting. Therefore will he give them up until the time that she which travaileth hath brought forth. Then the remnant of his brethren shall return unto the children of Israel. That's interesting in itself. The remnant of his brethren are going to return to the children of Israel. Verse 4, and he shall stand and feed in the strength of the Lord. How does he get the Lord's strength? He doesn't stand and feed in the strength of David. Doesn't stand and feed in the strength of Samson. He doesn't stand and feed in the wisdom of Solomon. He says, he shall stand and feed. So he's the one that feeds meat in due season. The one whom the Lord promised he was going to make ruler over his entire household. He says, he shall stand and feed in the strength of the Lord. How much strength does the Lord have? You ever think about that? Can the Lord lift a 100-pound weight? You got that much strength? Well, how much strength does the Lord have? We need to know that because that determines how much strength this ruler will be endowed with. You go back to Genesis, you find the Lord had a lot of strength. See, this is why I don't worry about conspiracies. I'm not concerned about the image of the beast and its activity. I'm not concerned about the Sunday blue laws. I'm not concerned about what the Masons are doing, or the Illuminati, or the Jesuits. There's all type of conspiracies out there. And some people need to worry about them, but not the disciples. Because David is going to stand and feed in the strength of the Lord, in the majesty of the name of the Lord his God. And they shall abide, for now shall he be great unto the ends of the earth. And this man shall be the peace. This is the man of peace. Remember, in Matthew chapter 10, the Lord says, think not that I came to bring peace on the earth but a sword. He's saying, I'm not the son of David. I'm not the one that's going to be made ruler. I'm making the son of David ruler over all that I have. It says, and this man shall be the peace when the Assyrian shall come into our land. Now, folks are looking to the day when troops are placed over in Palestine as a demarcation of when the kingdom is going to be established. But they really should be looking forward to the emergence of the mustard seed, Zerubbabel, the one without might and power. It says, he'll be the peace. If you want peace, peace, wonderful peace, then you're not to let this theme of the Lord's manifestation of his power come into your heart. This man shall be the peace when the Assyrian shall come into our land, and when he shall tread in our palaces. Then shall we raise against him seven, how many? Seven shepherds, eight principal females. Is that what it says? Eight principal men. So not only do we have the breakdown of the males and females now, we're just delineating the purpose of the males. You never ascribe to the female the purpose of military fortification. Have you? Maybe you have. Perhaps we need to turn quickly. It says, thus shall he deliver us from the Assyrian when he cometh into our land and when he treadeth within our borders. Hence, the person who's looking towards this man to resist the Assyrian are the portion of Israel that's weak, and they're looking for fortification. Numbers chapter 1. Some folks are thinking, well, my knees are hobbled. I can't barely stand up straight. I got to walk with a cane. Well, you better look forward to the day of eternal joy. the day when the Lord can rejuvenate you so that you could receive His might and His power. Numbers chapter 1, verse 2 and 3. Take ye the sum of all the congregation of the children of Israel, after their families, by the house of their fathers, with the number of their names, every male by their poles. That's why the book is called the Book of Numbers. It shows you how you number Israel. This is the numbering according to what it says in verse 3. From 20 years old and upward, all that are able to go forth to war in Israel. Now, Jerusalem is going to shoulder the burden of resisting the enemy. But their captains and their leaders, the ones that are going to take care of the heavies that are out there to attack them, are going to be the Lord's team of 7 plus 1. Zerubbabel and those 7. The shepherd, the 7 shepherds. There's a second dimension to this team. Can we get back to Zechariah? Let's flip over to the previous chapter, chapter 3, verse 8. It says, "Hear now, O Joshua, the high priest." So who's he talking to? Joshua, the high priest. "And thy fellows that sit before thee." Joshua has a team as well. His team is not the same as Zerubbabel's team. Zerubbabel has a team of 7. The Bible doesn't tell you how many are on Joshua's team. But look what it tells you. It says, "Hear now, O Joshua, the high priest, thou and thy fellows that sit before thee, for they are men wondered at. For behold, I will bring forth my servant, the branch." He's pointing Joshua and giving him the promise of David's emergence, when he refers to the branch. Verse 7, we really need to read. "Thus saith the Lord of hosts, if thou wilt walk in my ways, and if thou wilt keep my charge, then thou shalt also judge my house." He's not going to build the house. He's going to judge it. The son of David is the one whose purpose it is to build the house. If you read Zechariah chapter 6, it shows you that David is going to build the house, and Joshua, the high priest, is going to judge the house. He's going to be the one that's going to officiate over all the sacraments so that the house of God is run smoothly while you're out there preserving and protecting the kingdom through the Lord's might. "Thus saith the Lord of hosts, if thou wilt walk in my ways, and if thou wilt keep my charge, then thou shalt also judge my house, and shalt also keep my courts, and I will give thee place to walk among these that stand by." We have a further subdivision. Joshua is not counted among the disciples. If you go back and study the book of Numbers, you'll see that the Levitical order was not counted or numbered among the children of Israel. That was by law, because the Lord said, "They are mine. They are set apart." But yet their station, their rank in the kingdom, is given equal status with those that stand by. Those whom the Lord has prepared to receive Him at His coming, to be energized to represent His power in the earth. This makes sense. Y'all understanding this? So talk about subdivisions. Joshua is not given a seat to judge the house of Israel. He judges the whole temple and all the temple officiations. This is the separation of church and state as the Lord defined it. Therefore, when you speak of the wave sheaf, you can even go back to the illustration of Joseph in his dream. The brethren garnered together into sheaves, bundles, and those bundles represented their children. The ceremony of the wave sheaf was the harvesters were to go out and bring in a wave sheaf and present them to the high priest. The high priest himself did not do the harvesting. Harvesting is a synonym for house building. The disciples are sent out to gather together the children of Israel, beginning with 144,000 Jerusalem, and they are ordained for ministry by Joshua. Hence, amongst those that have the same rank are the brother, the sister, and the mother of the Lord. Included among that rank are the Levites, the high priests. They are given equal status, but different assignment than Zerubbabel and the 7, than David and his team of male disciples. Let's turn to John chapter 5. Remember, we posed the question, what are some of the things that the Father gave to Christ? What are some of the things that Christ has? Because the faithful and wise steward is made ruler over all that the Lord has. Remember, you need to know what the Lord has, right? Look what it says here. Verily, verily, that means it's got to be truthful. Verse 25. Verily, verily, I say unto you, The hour is coming, and now is, when the dead shall hear the voice of the Son of God, and they that hear shall live. The dead are going to hear the voice of God. Is that what it says? No. They're going to hear the voice of the Son of God. You can't understand this unless you're a scholar in Deuteronomy 18. Because in Deuteronomy 18, Christ made a covenant that he would no longer project his voice personally, but that he would do so, how? Through a prophet, like unto Moses, right? So it would be different if he said, you will hear the voice of the Spirit of God, or you will hear the voice of God. Now, when he says, you will hear the voice of the Son of God, then that's telling you that this is going to be the day whereby those seven shepherds, those seven eyes of the Lord, along with the ruler of Israel, are going to be empowered to gain rulership over the earth. They are going to be judges. That's why you have to have the law and the testimony, because your judgments are going to stand. You're going to measure the people according to the testimony of Jesus. This is why the Father gave this to us. It says, the dead are going to hear the voice of the Son of God, and they that hear shall live. This concept of judging really should not be strange to us as Adventists. Because we've always known that when we get up into heaven, what do? We judge the wicked, right? We give them sentence. The redeemed judge the wicked during the 1,000 years, and they determine the sentence. Well, that judgment starts before then. This is why you have to have the law and the testimony. When you have that, you're more qualified to judge than any of the angels, anybody else on earth. For as the Father hath life in himself, this is what I want you to hear, so hath he given to the Son to have life in himself. The Father's got life in himself. The Son hath life in himself. Christ promised that the faithful and wise ruler would be what? Made ruler over all that he hath. This is how he rules in the power of the Lord. It says, the Father hath life in himself. It says, so hath he given the Son to have life in himself. Obviously and evidently, the Son has life. Derek West didn't write this. Derek West is only opening up to you the testimony of Jesus. This was commanded of Christ to speak these things for this hour. Now what does it mean, the Son hath life in himself? He only has life himself because the Father, at some point in time, during his existence, you have life. He's talking to us in the context of resurrection. The Father can resurrect. He's got the power of life. And when Christ came down here, he showed you that he had the power to resurrect as well. It says, the Son hath life in himself. He hath given him authority to execute judgment also. Anybody that's raised children, understand what that means. You decide whether they violate the rules. Come in at 9 o'clock, and if you're late, then you have to meet the parental judgment, right? The Father honors that. It says, Christ hath the power to execute judgment also, because he is the Son of Man. Marvel not at this, for the hour is coming in which all that are in the grave shall hear his voice. You can't understand this, I reaffirm to you, unless you understand Deuteronomy 18, how the Son of Man projects his voice. Let's revisit the concept of heaven, life in himself. This life refers to the power to resurrect. That means that Christ has the power to call people forth from the grave to resurrect. He only has the power because the Father gave it to him. That's how he got the power. Think of it this way. You drive down the highway 60 miles an hour. Do you have the power in yourself to go 60 miles an hour? No. It's only the gasoline that you put in the car that operates efficiently that gives you power. If you had power in yourself to go 60 miles an hour, you would not need the car, would you? People would see you sitting in your chair, traveling down the highway 60 miles an hour. The Father has the power in himself to resurrect, and Christ has the power in himself to resurrect. Now we can go to John chapter 17. Let me just caution you, because I know how thoughts race through your mind. Some of these things, depending upon your experience with the Lord, are hard sayings. Who can hear them? I am just opening up to you what Father commanded Christ to say. Evidence of my inspiration to do this is the fact you never understood these things before. And Lord told you that the Father would send the Comforter to remind you of the things that the Lord told his disciples while he was yet with them. We're in John chapter 17, verse 6. It says, I have manifest thy name unto the men which thou gavest me out of the world. Thine they were, and thou gavest them me, and they have kept thy word. Now we can see. There's no need to look around at the disciples and snicker, like the Pharisees and the scribes and Sadducees and the Herodians did with the original 12. Huh? Is this all that he's got? Is that it? These people are people of no distinction, people that are not renowned. But when the Lord gives you his power, that makes all the difference, doesn't it? Then all those credentials that the other people who may have looked down upon you beforehand had are meaningless and useless. Because the Son of David rules in the power of the Lord, does he not? So when he says, Father has given him these men out of the world, your calling is a special calling. Not because of what you accomplished yesterday. Doesn't matter the bad habits that you had yesterday. Doesn't matter the bad crowds you hung out with. Doesn't matter the bad words that you used. It doesn't matter the dumb ideas that you had. Doesn't matter the mistakes. Father reached down through time and elected you for this power. That makes you special. There's something in you that only the Father could see. And that's the way it was with the original 11. Father gave them to Christ. You may not appreciate it. The academic, the spiritual, the political elitist may not have appreciated it. You may not be as high ranking as Barack Obama, but in God's eyes, you outrank him. This is why you're sitting in this study. Because Father has called you. Told you to pray that laborers will be sent into the harvest fields. And guess what? Guess who came forward amongst the throngs with a sickle on his shoulder? You. I have manifested thy name unto the men which thou gavest me out of the world. Thine they were, and thou gavest them me. And they have kept thy word. Verse 9. I pray for them. I pray not for the world. Christ's prayer was only for the disciples, not for the world. The ones that Father gave were the 11 disciples. He makes an exception in the text for Judas. Those are the people whom Christ prayed for. He didn't pray for the world. Why? Because you're going to see these are the people in the latter days, the disciples indeed, who are going to judge the world. I pray for them. I pray not for the world, but for them which thou gavest me. For they are thine. The people whom Father claimed were the disciples. Not the disciples 2,000 years ago, but the disciples today. The brothers, the sisters, and the mother of Christ. The Lord hasn't shown me who the mothers are. I wonder if that is prefigurative of the priesthood. It could be. I'm not sure. It says, and we're gone down to verse 20, neither pray I for these alone, but for them also which shall believe on me through their word. So there are a class of disciples, not worldlings, but disciples that are going to believe on Christ through their word. I'm a Christian. Not what he said. He said, those who believe on me. In order for you to believe on Christ, you have to know who Christ is. You have to come under the exposure of the what? The testimony of Jesus. You have to be enlightened by whom? The faithful and wise steward who's going to be made ruler over all that Christ had. He says, neither pray I for these alone, but for them also which shall believe on me through their word. So this prayer is applicable to the disciples indeed today. That they all may be one. He's praying that we'll be one. How are we going to be one? As thou, Father, art in me, and I in thee, that they also may be one in us. That speaks to the family concept. So when you're out there in Tasmania fighting the devil with the power of the Lord, you are one with the Father. He backs you up. He has authorized you to judge. He's given you authority to rule in the power of the Lord. This is where we're going. That they also may be one in us, that the world may believe that thou hast sent me. This is what we're studying now. See, the world doesn't believe that Father sent Christ. The Muslims don't believe that Father sent Christ. The Jews don't believe that Father sent Christ. Only the people who know Christ believe that Father sent Christ. Even the so-called Christians don't believe, because they think that Christ and Father are the same person. But how could they be the same person if the Father sent the Son? You have to be able to define the Father and the Son to believe that the Father sent Him. So we still see this dichotomy, this contrast between the world and the disciples. The Lord's prayer was for the disciples indeed, so that the day would come when the world would know that the Father has sent the Son.
That they all may be one, as thou, Father, art in me, and as I in thee, that they also may be one in us, that the world may believe that thou hast sent me. And the glory which thou gavest me, this is what I want you to see, the glory which thou gavest me, I have given them, that they may be one, even as we are one.
The glory was not just given to the faithful and wise steward. You have unity with his ministry. So the glory was projected to the disciples, the 12 disciples. This was Christ's petition. This is how he ended his ministry. This is his primary goal and objective, to empower you. So when we're told in Luke chapter 12 that he shall be made ruler over all that Christ hath, is told, we went and we've examined some of the things that were endowed to Christ. Those glorious things, like the ability to have life in yourself. Father gave that to Christ so that Christ had autonomous power to resurrect. And now Christ is petitioning that the day of unity will come when we're all walking in step so that we will have power to project his voice in the earth. That's the only way that the people in the grave are going to hear his voice, is if it's projected through his voice conveyance system.
Let me give you some more to think about just before we close. We mentioned war, didn't we?
You don't send the females off to war. That's never been God's way. I don't care how the armies today conduct themselves. Now, when you talk about numbers, it was garnering a way of measuring the people that were capable to go to war. So the chief officers will be those who are most capable. They represent the duties that the men going to be authorized to conduct. That's why in Micah chapter 5, you talk about the 7 shepherds and the ruler in Israel. Who's going to rule in the power of the Lord, right? It says they're going to be the military might. Israel is going to be frustrated because now that they understand that Palestine belongs to them, they become jealous of the fact that the Assyrian has moved in and controlled. So they look forward with great glee to the day when the Lord raised up his 7 shepherds. You don't need an army greater than that. You don't need glory more than that. You don't need an audience larger than that, because you're ruling in the power of the Lord. You're the eyes of the Lord that go throughout the earth. Why do you need that much power? You need that much power because the devil's going to raise that much hell. All those prophecies that we've read as Adventists about persecution, time of trouble, about the affliction of the church, about the Sunday laws, about delivering up before council. There are going to be times where the 144,000 are going to have to call in the heavy artillery, because they are the ones that are going to be faced with the thrust of the devil. If you rule in the power of the Lord, the devil can't touch you. In fact, the atonement setting shows at this point in time, he's escorted out. You're eternally free. Your joy is here. Now it's time for you to invite other Sabbath keepers to embrace the law and the testimony so they can enter into the kingdom as well. And you think that the enemy is going to stand still for that? No, he's going to master all the armament he can get his hands on, all the military muscle that he can amass. And he's got a lot of soldiers out there willing to fight and die for his cause.
And that's what our closing verse shows. It says in verse 15, Revelation chapter 12, "And the serpent cast out of his mouth water as a flood after the woman, that he may cause her to be carried away of the flood."
So he's fighting whom? The woman, who's symbolic of the church. What he's trying to do is he's trying to inundate the woman with a flood. This is why when you go into Seventh-day Adventist Church to try to teach, you can't get any traction, because the small number of disciples are drowned in the sea of demon-inspired terrors. That's how the devil planned and plotted to destroy the power of the woman.
"And the earth helped the woman, and the earth opened her mouth and swallowed up the flood, which the dragon cast out of his mouth."
So this period of destruction occurs within the church, where the Lord destroys the forces of evil that have inundated his church, and has left who behind? The woman. That was her help.
"And the dragon was wroth with the woman."
Who was he mad with?
The woman. "And went to make war with the remnant
of her seed. He's upset with the woman, but he has no power to go to war against her. Why? Because she comprises now, she has as her leadership the disciples, the males, the brethren of Christ, whose duty it is to fight with the power of the Lord. Therefore, Satan knows that he's outmatched. This is a force that he cannot resist. If they were fighting with human power, then they would be outmatched. So his anxiety is against the woman. Therefore, he goes to make war with the remnant of her seed. The remnant of her seed represent those people from the children of Israel who have passed through time without being destroyed, that are left on the earth. The remnant of her seed, which keep the commandments of God and have the testimony of Jesus Christ. Therefore, just as the work closes, as the midnight cry is sounded, your commission now will be to leave the church. You'll be commissioned with the assistance of Joshua, whom the Lord is going to garner in at that time, to go out and bring in. This is what we refer to in other contexts of Jacob typology as the altar at Bethel. During that period, that short period of 3.5 years, you're going to garner in from the Sunday-keeping churches the remnant of Israel. And the judgments, the wisdom, and the laws that you've learned, you're going to communicate to them. After that 3.5 year period, they are going to be officiated to be prophets, priests, and kings sent to evangelize the world. This is why the devil makes war with them. Their duty will be to do what the church has done all these years. Their duty will be to proclaim the truth more fully. So the devil is going to make war against them. That's the remnant of her seed. Those are the successful ones. How? Because they keep the commandments of God. Which commandment did they keep? The first commandment. You're going to teach them. They can't keep the first commandment unless the woman teaches them. And the second commandment, right? What about the third commandment? We saw they're going to keep the fourth commandment. To enter into the kingdom, your righteousness has to exceed the righteousness of the Sabbath-keeping scribes and Pharisees. So they have to become perfect practitioners. That means they're going to know it's lawful to do good on the Sabbath, because they will have the law and the testimony. So they keep the commandments of God and have the testimony of Jesus. And by having that, after your 3.5 years of instruction and enlightenment, gives them power to gain authority over the earth. But we see the purpose by which the Lord has for binding up the testimony and sealing the law amongst his disciples. When this event occurs, it's time to wait on the Lord. Why are you waiting on the Lord? Because you're disempowered now. But the day is going to come when Father is going to answer his prayer and is going to give to you the glory which he gave to Christ. This, the mustard seed, has been ordained to relay to you so that you can reminisce on these promises. Because this is the day when the church is going to shine forth in great glory and in great strength. Isaiah 60, verse 1, arise, shine, for thy light is come. Who's the light of Israel? The son of David. Metaphor, Zerubbabel, the faithful and wise steward. And the glory of the Lord is risen upon thee. For behold, the darkness shall cover the earth, and gross darkness the people. His brilliance, his glory, is going to shine through you. And his glory shall be seen upon thee. That's the answer to the Lord's Prayer in John chapter 17. And with that, we bring the study to a close.